This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 11, 2008, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. Activists around the world mark the six-year anniversary of the arrival of the first inmates at Guantanamo Bay. Two hostages held by FARC guerrillas in Colombia are released. We'll hear what political implications this might hold. And the war crimes trial against former Liberian President Charles Taylor resumes at The Hague. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Japan's lower house of parliament forced through controversial anti-terror legislation today. Debate over the bill fueled a six-month-long standoff between the ruling party's coalition and the opposition, led by the Democratic Party of Japan. The opposition-controlled upper house voted down the measure earlier this week. But in a very rare move, the lower house passed the bill by a two-thirds margin, enough for Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda to use a Japanese legal provision which allows the lower house to override an upper house decision. Today's two-thirds override was the first time legislation has been enacted in this way in Japan since 1951. The anti-terror legislation will allow Japanese forces to resume refueling support for U.S. ships involved in Afghan war operations. A Japanese Navy tanker and frigate escort are expected to return to the Indian Ocean blockade in 3 weeks. A team of doctors has announced that the health of Indonesia's former dictator has taken a turn for the worse, 1 week after he was hospitalized in critical condition. Chad Bouchard reports from Jakarta.
Doctors say the 86-year-old former dictator suffered multiple organ failure and became unconscious today after showing early signs of infection in his lungs. His condition improved slightly after a blood transfusion and kidney dialysis earlier this week, but deteriorated quickly today and has been placed on a ventilator. Surgeons say he needs a second pacemaker, but his condition is too frail to risk the operation. After 32 years of authoritarian rule, Suharto was forced out of office in 1998 amid a financial crisis and allegations of graft. He is accused of killing or jailing thousands of political opponents and stealing an estimated $15 to $35 billion. Suharto has denied the allegations. A series of minor strokes and declining health has kept him out of courtrooms in spite of several attempts to bring him to trial. His political party earlier this week called for prosecutors to drop pending cases against him, but the nation's attorney general refused. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
California state prosecutors have formally dropped conspiracy charges against four of the San Francisco Eight. The eight men are charged with the 1971 murder of a police officer. A ninth man, charged only with conspiracy, was able to walk free from the San Francisco courthouse yesterday. All of the San Francisco Eight are former members of the Black Panther Party. The same murder and conspiracy charges they now face were dropped in 1975 after their signed confessions were deemed inadmissible due to evidence of coercion and torture. The defendants entered formal not guilty pleas yesterday, nearly 1 year after the charges reemerged. The next hearing is scheduled for February 7th. In other legal news, the only officer convicted in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal has been cleared of all wrongdoing. Former head of the prison's interrogation unit, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan, was found guilty, not of torture, but of disobeying a command not to discuss the investigation. The military judge presiding over the case dismissed the conviction this week and replaced it with an administrative reprimand. Radio frequency identification technology has been touted as a means to keep cargo and ports safe from terrorist attack. But a recent study casts doubts on that theory. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
An experiment conducted by Powers International, a transportation security and logistics firm in North Carolina, showed that a detonator built by a college student from about $20 worth of Radio Shack parts could pick up a signal from an RFID reader and set off a small explosive charge set in an empty container. What may be even more disturbing is the lack of cooperation and response to the experiment by several government agencies. Dr. Jim Jamansky is chairman of Powers International.
We even had the local port director in Charlotte, North Carolina, who declined to participate, who declined to attend. We were in many ways impeded by CBP, with requests we made to use one of their proximity readers, and same thing with the Department of Defense. Oh, we can't let you use our stuff. And, you know, we've tried everything.
Representative Henry Cuellar, Democrat of Texas, of the U.S. House Committee on Homeland Security, plans to investigate the Department of Homeland Security's lack of response to the Powers study. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The D.C. District Court of Appeals dismissed a case today brought by four former British detainees against Donald Rumsfeld and senior military officers for ordering torture and religious abuse. This, as activists around the world mark the six-year anniversary of the first prisoners arriving at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. FSRN's Karen Miller has more from D.C.
D.C. Circuit Court Judge Karen LaCraft Henderson found that even though the Religious Freedom Restoration Act says that all persons have the right to be free from religious abuse, these prisoners did not qualify as persons because they were detained at Guantanamo. This effectively ruled that detainees are not persons at all for purposes of U.S. law. In addition, the judge said that the Geneva Conventions did not apply because, quote, torture is a foreseeable consequence of the military's detention of suspected enemy combatants. Eric Lewis is one of the lawyers for the detainees.
The D.C. Circuit essentially gave the government a complete victory, saying that detainees at Guantanamo have no constitutional rights, and that torturing and religious humiliation of detainees is considered within the job description or incidental to the job description of Donald Rumsfeld and the senior general.
Lewis says the next step will be to appeal the decision to the Supreme Court. This comes as human rights activists around the world today call for the Guantanamo prison to be shut down.
Counter terror with justice! Shut down Guantanamo! Counter terror with justice!
In Washington, D.C., hundreds of activists gathered under rainy skies wearing bright orange jumpsuits similar to those worn by Guantanamo Bay prisoners. They carried signs that read Counter Terror with Justice and placed life-size cutouts of Guantanamo Bay prisoners on the National Mall. It was 6 years ago today that the first prisoners were brought to the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Larry Cox, executive director of Amnesty International USA, says it's not a date that America should be proud of.
The abuse of human rights that's taking place in Guantanamo, the way that it weakens any genuine effort to improve security, what it is doing to the U.S. moral authority throughout the world, and more importantly, the suffering that we are inflicting on people who have never been convicted of a crime, have never even been charged with a crime, and yet are being held in terrible conditions year after year after year.
Timothy Higman traveled from New York to be at today's protest. He's an 18-year veteran of the military and says that the use of torture is reprehensible.
It's against the rule of law. It's against all international protocols on torture and the way to treat people. It's just un-American, and I'm outraged. What this country is founded on is absolutely not what our government's doing, and I'm here to speak out and protest for that.
Protesters also brought petitions signed by more than 100,000 people around the world calling for Guantanamo Bay prison to be shut down that will be taken to the White House. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
After a six-month break, the trial against former Liberian President Charles Taylor resumed in The Hague. Taylor is charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity, and it's expected that testimony from nearly 150 witnesses against him will take about 8 months. The specific charges include murder, rape, mutilation, and recruiting and using child soldiers, among others. Taylor, who has pled not guilty, is being tried in a hybrid international tribunal established through an agreement between the UN and Sierra Leone's government, which is one of the neighboring countries where Taylor's forces have been implicated in taking part in armed conflicts. We're joined on the line by Elise Kepler, senior counsel of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. HRW has really been at the forefront of bringing Taylor to justice for years. You just returned from The Hague to see the restart of the trial. What did it mean for you to finally see him in court?
The trial of Charles Taylor, from Human Rights Watch's perspective, is crucially important. for the victims of the crimes in Sierra Leone to have an opportunity to see justice done, and also as a strong signal that no one is above the law when it comes to these most serious crimes. And all too often in places like West Africa, there has been impunity for horrific atrocities. So it's in that framework through which we pressed for Taylor to face trial after he was indicted, and to see Taylor in the courtroom responding to the prosecution's case for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed in Sierra Leone is a very significant moment.
Taylor is charged with 11 specific counts. About half of those have to do with war crimes, specifically against women, including sexual slavery. Can you talk to us about what Taylor's forces did to women specifically?
Sexual slavery was a widespread crime committed in the conflict in Sierra Leone. And while the different parties in the conflict have been implicated in it, the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, and the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council, and these are the groups that Taylor allegedly backed during the conflict, are alleged of committing these types of atrocities. And that is a critical component of the charges alleged against Taylor.
And he's also accused of using child soldiers. How many children are we talking about, and can we expect to see any of them testify at his trial?
Really, the Sierra Leone conflict is characterized by the brutality of crimes, including against civilians, and child recruitment and sexual slavery were all too often part and parcel of the conflict. In terms of child witnesses, it's hard to say at this point. The prosecution hasn't given in-depth information about its crime-based witnesses who will testify. The prosecution has indicated they're going to have approximately 59 linkage witnesses, they call linkage witnesses, who will, according to the prosecution, provide information about the links between Taylor and the crimes with which have been implicated in Sierra Leone, the war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that is a critical component to establishing guilt in this case. And, of course, Taylor is entitled to every right of the accused and is presumed innocent. So unless the prosecution were to put forth evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the judge has found to be beyond a reasonable doubt, there couldn't be a conviction in this case. The prosecution has also indicated it will put forward approximately 77 crime-based witnesses, and those are victims who will testify to the crimes they suffered in Sierra Leone. However, they do anticipate putting forward approximately 90% of those in written testimony. So between the linkage witnesses and the crime-based witnesses, both of whom could involve former child soldiers, it's hard to know at this point whether or not they will actually testify live or in written form in the case.
I've been speaking with Elise Kepler, Senior Counsel of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Two political hostages who were kidnapped by Colombia's FARC guerrilla were released by the FARC yesterday. Manuel Rueda has more about the potential implications of the hostages' release.
Around noon, Venezuelan military helicopters landed at a remote location in Colombia, which was selected by the FARC for the release of former vice presidential candidate Clara Rojas and Congresswoman Consuelo González. Before the helicopters took off with the hostages, Venezuela's state-run television network captured images of both women speaking to President Chavez over a satellite phone.
Hello. Hello? Presidente. Ay, Presidente, mil gracias por toda su gestión humanitaria.
Oh, President. Thank you so much for your humanitarian accord. You can't let your guard down, President. Thank you. You're helping us to live again.
Gracias. Nos está ayudando, Presidente, a volver a vivir.
González and Rojas were met by their family members in an airport near Caracas, the Venezuelan capital. Later on, they attended a reception ceremony at the presidential palace. It was a well-scripted finale to a story that had taken countless hours of negotiations and television time. The FARC said that the hostage release was a promising step towards peace in Colombia. But it remains unclear whether yesterday's events will lead to the liberation of dozens of political hostages, including former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt. The FARC and the government are still at odds over the conditions that would secure the exchange of FARC hostages for imprisoned guerrillas. And in an address to the nation last night, President Álvaro Uribe did not show signs that he would comply with any of the FARC's requests, such as the withdrawal of the Colombian army from two strategic municipalities.
I call on everyone here tonight to firmly support the national security policy. We will obtain peace through a democratic and efficient security process. We will not attain peace with postures that appease terrorist groups.
The Colombian president thanked Chavez for his role in the liberation of Rojas and González. But he failed to mention whether the man who recently accused him of being a puppet of the American empire would be invited to mediate future hostage releases. In Washington, reporters asked the State Department if the U.S. would ask Chavez to mediate the liberation of three American FARC hostages. Spokesman Tom Casey replied that the U.S. strategy is to work exclusively through the Colombian government. But Casey did not quite rule the Venezuelan president out.
I think that anybody, including President Chavez, including anybody who has a role to play that is positive and that supports President Uribe and the Colombian government's efforts, is to be welcomed.
Back in Colombia, opposition politicians and human rights NGOs are pressuring Uribe to bring Chavez back to the negotiating table, and people are asking themselves whether Chavez is the only man who can broker a deal with the FARC. But during last night's speech, Uribe emphasized a solution that would rely on the mediation of the Catholic Church. Uribe is highly popular among Colombians, largely because of his tough stance against the FARC. And it looks like, for the moment, he can afford to keep Venezuela's controversial president at arm's length. Manuel Reda, FSRN, Bogota.
The South Carolina Republican primary holds a place in history as the first in the South primary. This year's primary is scheduled to occur on January 19. South Carolina is considered a must-win by Republican candidates who traditionally carry more southern states, and every Republican president since Reagan has won the South Carolina primary first before going on to win the presidency. According to an opinion poll taken by Fox News on January 9, John McCain is currently leading with 25% of the vote, followed by Mike Huckabee with 18% and Mitt Romney with 17%. Fox hosted the Republican debate in South Carolina Thursday evening, with candidates debating the economy, foreign policy, immigration, and religion. Huckabee differentiated himself from other nominees with his stance on Republican Party class dynamics.
We need to make sure that we communicate that our party is just as interested in helping the people who are single moms, who are working two jobs and still just barely paying the rent, as we are the people at the top of the economy.
Fred Thompson attacked Huckabee's comments, arguing Huckabee represented Democratic Party ideals more than he did Republican ideals. He cited Huckabee's support for closing Guantanamo Bay and funding programs that would help undocumented immigrants.
He would be a Christian leader, but he would also bring about liberal economic policies, liberal foreign policies. He believes we have an arrogant foreign policy and the tradition of blame America first.
Ron Paul attacked his fellow candidates on foreign policy issues, saying they were helping push the U.S. into a war with Iran. Paul has been somewhat championed for his more liberal stance on foreign policy issues and his opposition to the war in Iraq. However, not all of his policies stem from a liberal politic. At a press conference in New Hampshire on Monday, Paul addressed questions about numerous donations he received from Ku Klux Klan websites.
No, I don't know anything about it, but I'm not going to send the money back. Sending it back would imply that people who send me money have an influence on me. I mean, what about people who raise millions of dollars from the military-industrial complex, and that's corrupt? Do they send their money back?
That was Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul defending why he accepts donations from Ku Klux Klan websites. Polish Minister of Defense Bogdan Klich announced that Poland will not agree to host a U.S. anti-missile site unless Washington commits to boosting Polish air defense. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk said that his approval for a planned U.S. missile defense shield would depend on a greater U.S. contribution to Poland's security. FSRN's Danuta Eisler reports from Warsaw.
It was in early 2007 that Washington has officially asked Prague and Warsaw to host a tracking radar and 10 interceptor missiles, respectively, in an effort to ward off potential attacks by so-called rogue states, notably Iran. Both countries entered into bilateral negotiations soon after. The arrival of the new Polish government, led by the Liberal Civil Platform, has not changed the pace of the talks, but brought a change of negotiating tactics, seen by many as aimed at getting more tangible results. For example, bolstering Poland's outmoded air defense capabilities. Prime Minister Donald Tusk announced that Poland will now consider installation of the shield, but on condition that it will increase rather than decrease the security of Poles. He also said that what is of primary importance is not the pace of the negotiations, but whether the United States meets the expectations of the Polish and Czech sides.
Do tej pory w trybie negocjacji poprzedników nie uzyskała polska strona zapewnienia ani gwarancji, że...
Up to now, in negotiations headed by our predecessors, Poland did not gain assurances or guarantees that the American anti-missile installations will increase the security of our country. As the new head of the Polish government, I feel responsible for the security of Poles and not for the security of our biggest ally. Of course, with all due respect to the United States.
From the onset, Polish public has expressed unwillingness to embrace the U.S. project. According to some estimates, as many as 70% of Poles are against the idea, with a similar opposition in the neighboring Czech Republic. It has also stirred opposition from many analysts. Professor Roman Kuźniar, former head of the Polish Institute for International Relations in Warsaw, claims that the deployment of the shield in Poland is not a good idea, as it may bring more harm than benefits to this country.
The shield will be exterritorial, which means that the decision to use it will lay in the hands of the Americans. So in the worst-case scenario, it may happen that the Polish leaders, who in accordance with our constitution decide on Poland's participation in a military conflict, will find out from big media, like CNN, that they are already part of a conflict, because anti-missiles have just been launched from Polish territory. And this would be a part of an American offensive against a certain country.
Prime Minister Donald Tusk has just paid a visit to Prague, where both prime ministers agreed that Poland and the Czech Republic should adopt a common stand on the deployment of a U.S. anti-missile defense shield in their countries. Apart from coordinating its moves with Prague, Warsaw also has to address Russia's objections to a U.S. plan for a missile shield in Central Europe, which is perceived in that country as a threat to national security. In an unprecedented move, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Kislyakov paid a low-profile visit to Warsaw to discuss the Russian stand on the matter. Speaking earlier, during an annual conference, President Vladimir Putin reiterated that U.S. plans are directed against Russia.
Террористов есть баллистическое оружие, что ли? А траектория полетов ракет, которые могут запускаться, скажем, с иранской территории, тоже...
Do terrorists have any ballistic rockets? Also, the trajectory of Iranian rockets is also known. They simply do not have ballistic rockets. They have middle-range rockets, but I don't remember how many. That's why such arguments are groundless. Hence, it is obvious that such installation would concern Russia as well.
Meanwhile, the Polish MOD announced that the Polish government wants to repair its relations with Russia and will try to convince the Russian government that there is no need to be afraid of the shield. Such a move provoked criticism not only from the opposition. Aleksander Szczygło is a former defense minister and member of the opposition Law and Justice Party.
Why do we need to consult Russia here? Are these Russian or American rockets that are to be deployed on our territory? This is really quite a dangerous step, which sends a signal to the Russian government that in the future, the Polish government will consult matters related to its security with Moscow. This is very dangerous.
Answering to the announced change of tactics in negotiations, spokesman of the U.S. Department of State Sean McCormack called Poland a, quote, good American friend and ally, and said that its interest will be taken into consideration. Poland's Defense Minister Bogdan Klich will further discuss them during his talks with American Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in Washington on January 14 through 16, while Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk announced he will be going with a similar purpose to Moscow on February 8th. I'm Danuta Isler, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
Grand jury, FBI, U.S. Justice, this is our line.
denouncing a new wave of repression against the Puerto Rican independence movement. Activists have held protests for the past 2 days in Puerto Rico, New York City, and various other locations around the country. These protests were directed at the convening of a grand jury against at least 3 Puerto Rican cultural and social workers in New York City, FSRN's Andalucia Knoll reports.
Julio Pavón, an aspiring filmmaker, Tanya Frontera, a graphic designer, and Christopher Torres, a social worker, were all subpoenaed to appear in a federal grand jury in Brooklyn, New York today. Frontera and Torres have been active in the struggle against the U.S. Navy's bombing of Vieques, as well as a successful movement to free Puerto Rican political prisoners. However, Pavón has had little political involvement. The three had supposedly been issued subpoenas to speak about the underground Puerto Rican independence group, the Macheteros. The FBI has postponed today's grand jury until February 1st. New York City Councilwoman Melissa Mark Viverito says that Puerto Rican activists of all stripes have historically been met with state repression.
We do not want to revisit the tactics that were implemented as late as the 70s and even the 80s when the Puerto Rican independence movement and activists in general were under great surveillance as a way of monitoring and tracking what ultimately in many cases was found to be legitimate political dissent.
Ana Lopez with the Hostos January 11th grand jury resistance campaign says that activists in Puerto Rico have been under increasing surveillance since the 2005 death of Filiberto Ojeda Urrios. Ojeda Urrios was a founding member of the Macheteros and was killed in a shootout with the FBI in a small village in Puerto Rico.
They have gone into people's homes, taken their laptops and papers.
Ana Lopez believes that the FBI was also looking to serve Hector Rivera, a member of the cultural activist group The Welfare Poets, with a subpoena as they went looking for him at his father's house in the Bronx. Hector Rivera says it's ironic that the FBI is on a, quote, witch hunt for terrorists when he believes it is the U.S. that has committed state-sponsored terrorism in Puerto Rico.
Worst type of terrorism has been the over 100 years of U.S. colonialism and how that has manifested in Puerto Rico. For 60 years, the U.S. Navy bombed Vieques, where there were over 10,000 residents living.
When asked to comment on these subpoenas on the grand jury, the New York Press Office of the FBI responded.
Absolutely not. By federal law, grand jury proceedings are secret. So we can't comment on whether there is a sitting grand jury, let alone whether particular people have been subpoenaed to testify.
It is the secretive nature of grand juries that Bob Boyle of the National Lawyers Guild says is most problematic.
At the request of a prosecutor, a grand jury can summon anyone to appear and testify for virtually any reason. A grand jury meets in secret with only the grand jurors, the prosecutor, and law enforcement present. A witness may not bring his or her attorney into the grand jury room. A witness may not object to questions on the ground they are not relevant to a legitimate grand jury investigation.
A broad coalition of supporters has been formed to resist the grand jury, as they feel that this crackdown on dissent has far-reaching repercussions.
This is successful, then I think the precedent is horrible, actually, for not just Puerto Ricans, but for everyone, really. Because then maybe, you know, who's next in terms of, like, cultural workers? Who's next in terms of voices of ours? Who's next in terms of organizers who are there to say no to human rights abuses? Who are they to say that, yeah, you know, there are international laws out there that the U.S. continues to violate?
While 250 people gathered today in Brooklyn and hundreds more across the U.S. and Puerto Rico, members of the Puerto Rican community say they will continue to fight for their independence and will not let the FBI silence them. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Null in New York City.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Special thanks today to Catherine Jarmoul and to Davey D. and Hard Knock Radio. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.